tonight on Arena. We review new albums, including Taylor Swift's The Life of a Showgirl, and in TV, it's How Are You? It's Alan Partridge, The Hack, and Chad Powers. Five one five five one. If you'd like to get in contact tonight by text, please do. You can drop an email to arena@rte.ie, or you will find us on Instagram at @rte_arena. Taylor Swift's new album, The Life of a Showgirl, lands just months after her record-breaking Eras tour and her hugely successful, if divisive, Tortured Poets Department. Teaming up for the first time in a long time with producer Max Martin, she leans into big pop production, Vegas-style glamour, and a love-soaked lens on fame and performance. James Morrison releases his sixth studio album, Fight Another Day, his first in 6 years. The record follows a period of personal tragedy after the death of his long-term partner in early 2024. Across 13 tracks, he blends his familiar pop soul sound with themes of loss, recovery, and hope. And Ash are back with Ad Astra, album number 9 from the band from Downpatrick. Across the album, they have the usual mix of guitar-driven rock, bit of experimentation, some collaborations, including work with Blur's Graham Coxon, and they maintain the sound that has defined their three-decade career. I'm joined tonight by Louise Bruton and Kian Sullivan. Let's start with Taylor Swift, shall we? We're going to roll our sleeves up for this one. We don't have to tell you that Taylor Swift is one of the biggest artists on the planet. 11 albums in, halfway through the Eras tour, the most successful tour in history, and newly engaged to Travis Kelce. Where does The Life of a Showgirl fit into the Taylor Swift story so far? I'm going to start by giving you just a little bit of it. This is the opening track, and it's called The Fate of Ophelia.
Quite the pyro, you light the match to watch it blow.
That's how it opens. It is Taylor Swift's The Fate of Ophelia. The album billed as her big, glittering return to pop, in inverted commas. Kind of behind the curtain, look at her life as a performer. Louise, did it actually feel like that to you, or does this fall into more familiar, if older, territory?
The rollout of this album and the spectacle in which she announced it on her fiancé's podcast the week that they also then announced their engagement, it's been delivered and it seems like it's been received as this big turning point in her career. But there are no waters here that she hasn't tread before. That song there, The Fate of Ophelia, is the opening song on the album, and it's probably the most upbeat song on the album. But to describe it as a banger would be incorrect. To describe it as a sparkling pop song would be also incorrect. This album is produced by Max Martin and Shellback, who are two of the biggest pop producers of the 20th and 21st centuries. They've worked with Taylor Swift before on some of her biggest singles like Blank Space, We Are Never Getting Back Together Again, Trouble, all the big, big pop songs that did actually change her output from country gal to bona fide pop star. But this just doesn't feel like a sheeny pop album. It feels like a soft rock album at best. I've divided my critiques into categories of the good, which Ophelia is there, the dull, and the cringe.
Right, that's where we're going. Kian, you were saying you have a list of Max Martin songs. And I only ask this because I think we had a conversation off air about how this doesn't necessarily sound like some of the music that he's produced before. And the man is responsible for some of the best known pop songs of the 21st century.
Absolutely. So between him and Taylor Swift, they have 35 US number ones of the last 25 years. So they are absolute hit makers. Some of those examples are Britney Spears' Baby One More Time, Katy Perry's Kissed a Girl, and you've got The Weeknd, I Can't Feel My Face, Justin Timberlake, Can't Stop the Feeling. And the kind of theme with certainly his most successful hits for Max Martin are huge, bombastic, anthemic pop anthems. And I think a lot of people following Taylor Swift's kind of folklore era during the pandemic, coming out of the two albums since then, it's been very much sort of mid-tempo, rounded synth pop music, which she worked with Jack Antonoff, her former producer. And I think a lot of people, myself included, thought we were going back to this big floor-filling pop bangers. And in terms of like the pedigree of the people involved in writing this, this ends up coming out as pretty average.
Louise, I know you have thoughts about Taylor's cultural dominance and the fact that sometimes the conversation around her can drown out the music itself. Do you think that the reaction to the album even today says something about where pop criticism is right now?
So Taylor Swift is first and foremost a celebrity, and I think she's then a songwriter after that. So there are so many references in this album that I don't think a lot of people will get unless they've been following all of the different dramas that she's been going through with other pop stars, with, you know, with the press as well. She has often kind of taken jabs at different publications for not siding with what she believes is her greatest work. And you know, she'll say then the next album after that will be her greatest work as well. But this album has been getting a lot of 5 stars. And I would love to speak face to face with any of the journalists who have given this album 5 stars and to just find out why this album is the best that it is, that it could be. Because the production of it is fine. It's not incredible. The songwriting at points is just embarrassing. And it feels like the first draft, this feels like a kind of a voice notes note to self going, OK, I'll write a song about this. And then what she's written has ended up being the song that we're all listening today.
I'm interested in your cringe section. What makes you cringe about the songs in the cringe section?
I think there's a song called Actually Romantic, which I just find incredibly embarrassing from what is one of the best songwriters of our time. It's supposedly a clapback to Charlie XCX's song Sympathy is a Knife, which was written about feeling intimidated by being in the same room as someone in the same industry who is far more successful than you, which is a very real thing to feel. And instead of Taylor Swift replying to that song from the other side of knowing, when I walk into a room, I know a lot of people are afraid of me and they can't be my friend, she writes a song that is basically just a sticks and stones may break my bones, but I actually think you fancy me. So it just feels so immature. It feels so ridiculous that I just can't believe that she, as a very hugely celebrated songwriter, could have been possibly poring over every line here. She even compares the subject of this song to a chihuahua and a little handbag, which, you know, is it misogynistic? Kind of.
Lest you think Louise is making that up, let's have a listen to this. This is Actually Romantic.
I heard you call me boring Barbie when you're out feeling brave. High fived my ex and then you said you're glad he ghosted me. Wrote me a song saying it makes you sick to see my face. Some people might be offended, but it's actually sweet. All the time you've spent on me, it's honestly wild. All the effort you've put in, it's actually romantic. I really gotta hand it to you. Ever loved me like you do. Hadn't thought of you in a long time, but you keep sending me funny Valentines. And I know you think it comes off vicious, but it's precious, adorable. Like a toy chihuahua barking at me from a tiny purse. That's how much it hurts. How many times has your boyfriend said, why are we always talking about? It's actually sweet. All the
from the new Taylor Swift album, Actually Romantic. Kian, I mean, there are moments of self-awareness on this album. There's a lot of cattiness in certain songs on this record. The feuds are here, the rivalries are here. Is it now at a point where this is starting to feel tired and that she's better than this?
I definitely think she's better than this. Not only does it feel tired, it feels... So she's famous for her penchant for petty, you know, payback for people who have wronged her. And, you know, a lot of her success at the start was getting back at boyfriends who had wronged her. And I guess, you know, like, we can't argue with Heartbreak, even though we're only hearing one side of it. And then she's moved in her last album on to a takedown of Kim Kardashian because there was this big fallout over Reputation. And now it's this where it's seemingly, if everything that happened here is just what we know, seems to be her just punching down on an artist who isn't as successful as her. You know, there's other songs in this called Father Figure where she's like, you know, talking about a protege and then kind of buries them because she believes that they betrayed her. There's a song called Cancelled, which is absolutely bizarre. It feels like she's like evil maniacally laughing over in the corner like Cruella de Vil. It's totally kind of tone deaf. And it's kind of, maybe she's having this crisis when she's like, when I've got no adversaries to, you know, pick on, who? What do I do? And maybe her focus is lost.
When you have conquered all of those worlds.
Exactly.
Louise, she has this ability to reinvent herself almost on a yearly basis from album to album to album to album. Do you think that Life of a Showgirl is a reinvention of any kind?
I would disagree with the fact that she reinvents herself. She just gets a new haircut. That's hardly reinvention. But I feel like her where she is at her best is when she is writing about sensitive material using very kind of poetic metaphors, and a lot of that came on the Folklore and Evermore albums, where she was far more introverted and she let her personal grievances kind of be not the focal point of the songs, but she just let her literary skills really kind of shine through. But now it's all a bit tit for tat, and I don't think it's a reinvention. And when we think of Showgirl, like, there's the person who did the Showgirl tour is Kylie Minogue. That's what we think of when we think of a big pop showgirl who knows how to bring the kind of the dazzle and the spectacle, and also to be quite camp and also just know how to share a bit of joy. But I just don't find this to be a very joyful album. Even the songs that are about being in love with her fiance are more about adoring certain parts of his body. So it just doesn't, none of it sits right with me, especially that song Cancelled that Kian was given out about.
Okay.
There.
Stars from you?
2.5. Don't kill me, Swifties.
Yeah, it's a total misnomer. You don't get anything behind the scenes like she promised. It is a love album and it's disappointing. It's 3 stars for me.
Okay. James Morrison has been part of British pop and soul for nearly 2 decades now. You gave me something with 2006. Fight Another Day is the new record. Kian, where does this album find him? I mean, both personally and artistically, because the two are connected.
Yeah, not in a great place. Morrison lost his wife, unfortunately, in January last year. Jill Catchpole passed away from suicide. So you can imagine how truly earth-shattering this was for him and his family. He had been making music since pre-pandemic before that, and he shared that when he leaned into how he was feeling post his wife, that's when the song started coming. He started writing from what he was going through. He was struggling with himself. Every day became a bit of a battle. And that's sort of the place that he has crafted these songs. He is sticking to his sonic palette of pop and soul. He's also thrown in 2 songs that are sort of inspired by his favourite artists in there, Stevie Wonder and Jamiroquai. So yeah, obviously going through a lot of pain, but I do have to say, in the rollout for this album, and I guess, you know, in the lyrics, there's not a lot of lyrical specificity, and maybe, you know, he's not really ready to get into it, which kind of feels like a bit of a missed opportunity.
Louise, do you feel that the grief that obviously he's gone through shapes the tone of the album, or is he, as Kina suggested, just skirting around it?
Well, I think it's a funny thing to try and speak on when you obviously haven't gone through something that he has. And I think that he has always been an emotive songwriter. He's always been an emotive vocalist. And what happened to him and his family is such a huge, huge tragedy. And he's now in this role of having to be a single father to his, I think, teenage and then preteen child. So he's had to review everything. But the thing is, there's moments of absolute pain on a song like called Slow Heart Attack, I think it captures the heaviness that his life has gone through and how he's kind of almost like bursting under the seams of this emotional and professional and parental pressure. But at his core, I think he's a very positive person. There's a song called Silver Lining, which delves further into the pressures and the darkness. He's never felt worse, but the world doesn't stop turning, so he goes on. I think that shows kind of strength in his character, and maybe not necessarily that he's not ready to, because it's up to him to decide how he packages his personal experiences. And he's sort of an artist that you listen to in the queue for Starbucks. Like, he's not exactly, he's not the one that you're going to for emotional guidance. He's going there for someone to just be an easy listen.
Okay, let's have a listen to Slow Heart Attack from the album.
Second time around, it's still you. And I'm still trying to chase something. The kid's giving me nothing, nothing. When you're blinded by the high, you always think that you can fly until you hit the ground. Don't you know? Don't you know?
James Morrison, Slow Heart Attack. Kian, the album is polished. I mean, it's got that kind of James Morrison sound that people will recognise, a lot of warmth, a lot of soul to it. Does that work with the kind of emotional weight that is part of the subjects when it comes to the song?
Well, absolutely, because his strongest asset on both regards is his voice. You heard it there. It sounds absolutely gorgeous. It is dripping in emotion. And all he needs to do is create these nice, you know, pop landscapes behind him to really accentuate it. Like, you've got this kind of like distorted blues guitar on 10,000 Men, these Motown brass on New Day. You've got piano flourishes on Cry Tears on Me. And they just really help him convey the message. Like, he sounds great on all these tracks, even when he's doing some Stevie Wonder and some Jamiroquai as well. So yeah, this actually really, really works for me. I think this is a really nice car record on like a kind of sunny day. There's lots of different sounds, but they're all very pleasant. He actually wrote that the sort of music he loves is music he's never heard before, but he feels he instantly recognises. And I think that's kind of what this record sounds like.
Louise, sometimes his previous albums, they can kind of blur together a little bit. Do you think this one, that Fight Another Day, does anything to stand out from the rest of them?
Yeah, he's been on the go basically for the last 19 years, and I could not tell you a difference between any of the songs unless it's the duet with Nelly Furtado.
Nelly Furtado, yeah.
And, you know, signifier there is it's a different voice. I do feel that this is maybe a kind of a new chapter for him, in a sense where he has said that he has been going through a lot of therapy and kind of putting everything that he's learned through that and the experiences of 2024 into his songs. It might unlock a new approach to how he does his songwriting. Certainly, I think vocally he's taken a new turn where it is far more interesting and far more vulnerable. So hopefully this is sort of a new path for him in terms of what he can do.
Okay, stars from both of you. Kian?
Surprise, surprise, I like this more than Taylor Swift. This is 3.5 for me.
Louise?
Oh, just a nice 3 for me.
We're going to finish this week, 3 decades on from Girl from Mars. Ash have a new album. It's called Ad Astra. Louise, it opens with this almost prog rock reworking of Richard Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra. It's a really tongue-in-cheek way to start an album. Did you enjoy that?
I really enjoyed this album, I have to say. And I know that this is where Kian and I are going to be at odds with each other. But yes, it starts out so big and so hammy and so camp. And it's full of this pop punk energy that they had back when they were releasing their music back in the early 90s as teenagers. And that is sort of an amazing thing that Ash, the the boys from Downpatrick have managed to maintain this youthful energy, not just in their approach to their music, but also their collaboration and Tim Wheeler's vocals as well. So Ad Astra means to the stars, and it's a nice throwback to 30 years ago when it was Girl from Mars has the lyric, and As I Look to the Stars. So it feels like this is an album that is celebrating the entirety of their career, and you know, that they're also just not stuck to that sound as well.
Cian, I'm being led to believe you don't feel the same way.
No, not necessarily. I think it's what really threw me is, like, so I enjoyed the kookiness of the opening track. I was like, this is fun. I'm on board. And then there was the mind-boggling decision for them to cover the Calypso classic Jump in the Line by Harry Belafonte, which had me stopped in my tracks for all the wrong reasons. But that beyond, I totally agree with Louise. Like, you know, they are making music for their fan base, and I think it has everything that fans of Free All Angels will still enjoy. You've got your surf rock, you've got your kind of punk in there, you've got these crunchy fuzzy guitars, there's kind of Muse at time, there's Talking Heads at time. I actually think the cinematic track Deadly Love is a really shimmering highlight on the record, and you know, Graham Coxon is on this from Blur playing guitar, so I think if you're a fan, there's plenty on this for you to like.
I'm going to take just a brief clip of their version of Harry Belafonte's Jump in the
Line.
Just a little. Just a little. That's all you're getting, and then you can listen to the album if you want to. Louise, Tim Wheeler's voice, it still has that kind of teenage passion in it. He's in his 40s now. He still sounds like he's 19 years old.
Yeah, and I remember one of the first times I heard the Free All Angels album, I was like at the Gaeltacht getting a lift from a Coon tour, and they had the tape, and I just remember they were breaking the English speaking rule and they were singing Os Berla, and I was like, oh, this is a cool moment. But there's one song in particular that just gives me such joy, and it's Hallian. It's got this beautiful kind of Nordy Irish quality going to it, and the line, like, she's a wee Hallian. I just think that it's incredible that we can have the word wee and Hallian in a song. And Tim Wheeler, it sounds like Burn Baby Burn, which, I mean, I don't even know how old that song is, but he has maintained that youthfulness, and I think it's because he enjoys what he's doing, and I feel like you can almost hear him smiling as he sings. And it's just, you know, I was listening to Ash's Ad Astra as I was driving through Storm Amy to get here, and I just felt happy. And I think that is, you know, that's a great achievement to have with a record, to make something that doesn't necessarily mean too much, but it brings a lot of joy.
Okay, this is the title track from the album. And that's Ash, Ad Astra. Cian, I mean, they've always been Ash over the years. They've never gone through the whole reinvention thing. Do you think that's a strength or a weakness?
I think, for me, I guess it's a bit of a weakness. I guess I like to see change and development and growth. But at the same time, you know, you don't have a situation with us giving out about Taylor Swift, because you're stuck in a malaise. They find some way to have the courage to remain themselves and keep the output just as interesting. And it's kind of like, we know what you like. This is what we like making. Wham, bam.
Stars from you?
3 from me.
Okay, Louise?
3.5 from me.
Okay. Louise Bruton, Cian Sullivan, thanks for running the rule over this week's music for us. We'll take a break and we're back looking at this week's TV. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. On tonight's TV reviews, How Are You? It's Alan Partridge is the latest project of the fictional self-absorbed broadcaster Alan Partridge, created by and starring Steve Coogan. This time, Alan is just back from a stint working for the government of Saudi Arabia and is presenting what he claims is the first ever documentary exploring the state of Britain's mental health. The Hack is a new crime drama series on Virgin Media TV. It's based on the real-life events surrounding the News International phone hacking scandal. It stars David Tennant as journalist Nick Davies, who exposes illegal practices in Rupert Murdoch's News of the World. The drama also interweaves the unsolved 1987 murder of investigator Daniel Morgan, revealing media corruption and police ties. And finally tonight, Disney bring us Chad Powers, a sports comedy starring Glenn Powell as quarterback Russ Holiday. He loses his career and standing after a disastrous altercation at a football game. He decides to reinvent himself years later by disguising himself as Chad Powers and joining a struggling Southern college football team. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have watched all three. They are with me now. First up, the return of the one and only Alan Partridge. It's more than 30 years since we first saw him on Chris Morris's The Day Today. Chris, set the scene for us as to where we are when we start.
Where we are is with Alan Partridge trying to make yet another comeback. And I had to suppress the giggles there when you said the name of this show, because it's the best, it's the most Alan Partridge title.
You have to get the emphasis right, it's how he says it.
That's exactly it. Look, the last time we saw Alan Partridge, he was on the comeback trail. He actually had landed a co-presenting gig on the BBC, and that's all he ever wanted to do. He wanted to be back in front, you know, of the camera. Unfortunately, he made a right mess of it. He had a massive meltdown on live television. He fell out with sidekick Steve, played by the prolific Tim Key. It all went south on him. So the BBC gave him his marching orders. He had to get out of the country. At the start of How Are You, we see that he, you know, to pay the bills, went to Saudi Arabia to promote camel's milk. Yes, that is a sentence I just said. Eventually comes back to Norfolk, can't land a gig at Norfolk Digital, can't get anything other than voiceover work or basically, you know, advertising tacky pub meal deals in Norfolk, and also doing some promotional work where he is a guest or something like an MC at a cow and pig food event. But it's at this event that he, unfortunately, he has a bit of a moment. He collapses into a woman's lap and it becomes a bit of a viral moment, and he's happy with that. But it makes him think, why did I collapse? Well, he says, now these are his words, that mental health has never been bigger. There's more mental health now, he says, than there ever used to be. So maybe I'm included in that. Maybe I have a mental health problem. So he thinks that he's going to be the first man in British television history, with a lot of help from his assistant, to make a documentary about mental health.
Let's take something from it. This is Steve Coogan volunteering as Alan Partridge at a soup kitchen, but having some reservations about some of the homeless young men that he meets there.
5 years ago, I agreed to help out one evening a month at this soup kitchen. And whilst I've had to cancel on each occasion due to unforeseen circumstances, I send along my assistant instead, and I do so free of charge. The homeless get a warm feeling from the soup. I get a warm feeling from having seconded my assistant, and I dare say she gets something from it too.
You come from?
And so, after putting on an apron using the spin, tuck and tie technique, favoured by both the US Army Catering Corps and horrible Greg Wallace, it was down to work.
You homeless? Have some soup. You homeless? Have some soup. Are you homeless? A little bit of soup.
What are you doing?
Yeah, I'm just trying to weed out the blaggers. Yeah.
You can just serve the soup.
Yeah, I saw a guy over there in a North Face jacket.
Yeah, he could have got it from a charity shop.
Open your eyes, mate.
Yeah. Jen, it's been 4 years since he was fired from North Norfolk Digital, since they separated ways. You know, should he have just faded away into obscurity?
We like seeing Alan on the edge. I mean, when we see Alan Partridge previously, when you're living at a travel lodge with Alan's big plate, we want to see him in Desperate Measures. That's when he succeeds, and that's where the comedy comes from. It's his desperation to get back, to force his way back into the mainstream, to force his way back into the industry. And I think he thinks that with mental health issues, he's picked a worthy topic, something that he knows is awards baity. And then he has his own personal tribulations, as Chris has outlined, passing out in a lady's lap twice, that make him appear more empathetic. And that is, you know, there's the shrewdness to the Alan Partridge character that you see it as blatant. You know it's blatant as an audience, but he thinks he's pulled one over on everyone. And I think one of the creators, I think the two creators, the twins, the Gibbons twins, have done something so great with Alan. I mean, they've said, though, that this particular show, it's the vanity project of a fading presenter who wants to try out all the tools of being a documentary maker, hoping that something will stick and I'll make it work. And it's not as if we haven't been party to seeing celebrities repeating this trick over the years, and that makes it even more accurate. And I think the attention to detail and that accuracy, the precision of the writing, is what is makes it so brilliant. Even after 30 years or more, you're still finding layers within the Alan Partridge character. He could go on forever, and that's what's so amazing about it.
The fact that Steve Coogan takes him away for a few years at a time and then comes back with him. Does that help with the freshness, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I think the gap years help. I mean, if Coogan had stayed inside the lines and if this were his only concern, if this were his only gig over those 30-odd years, we'd have grown bored of the character. But I think another interesting move was to actually bring in the Gibbons, because I think a decision was made at one point that, you know, a sketch is all well and good, and we've seen Steve Coogan play Alan Partridge and write Alan Partridge across all types of mediums and platforms, from, you know, this, or from radio to the screen to the stage to the big screen even. But a parody can't last forever. A person maybe might. And that decision to kind of make him more personable and to give him a personality, to turn him from, you know, the most awkward, cringe-inducing, you know, parody, or, you know, sport broadcaster in the room, to something almost like a giddy Labrador of a man, where he's forever putting his foot in it, he's forever making all these, you know, horrendous mistakes, but you look at him and you go, oh, but you kind of feel sorry for him. you want to like him, you're rooting for him, even though he's saying the worst things imaginable. And I think it's that. I think it's the effort that's gone into, you know, it's not just one, it's not just a single joke. This is a full-bodied character here. I think all of that effort shows in this latest series.
And I think it's because Alan, as a character, he's not outwardly cruel like somebody like David Brent, and he's not belligerent like somebody, a very real presenter like someone like Piers Morgan, because there's no comedy in that. There's no real fun or longevity in that. And we enjoy watching Alan bumble his way through the modern world because we know that he's trying to adapt to things in his own way, and he's trying to get his head around concepts like Me Too, which we saw him do before on This Time, or gender identity politics, which he addresses quite blatantly at the very start of this documentary, which is extremely funny. And I think for someone who has been around for so long, I think with something like Gervais's David Brent, that devolved into a one-note joke, Alan contains those multitudes that we've just said there, and he's never outstayed his welcome. He's always popping in and out of our lives, and I think that's the best way to keep it.
Okay, here's something else from the programme, and it does figure Tim Key, who seems to be in every second thing that happens anywhere these days, and that's fair enough. He reflects on some of the good times he had at North Norfolk Digital with sidekick Simon, played by Tim Key.
Now time for something we call Rash Decision.
Rash decision.
Your medical ailments answered once again. Dr. Andy can't be with us, but please do keep sending in your pictures of rashes. Simon and I both have access to Google Images and will provide a layman's view of exactly what the ailment is.
And a reminder, our diagnoses have no medical basis.
Yes, indeed.
Let's look at some rashes.
You're a first aider.
I am indeed.
But you haven't given first aid.
No.
Even when that woman collapsed. Do you think you were in shock?
I think I probably was.
Yeah. First is from Heidi Trentham, or is it Trentham?
Trentham. Trentham Gardens.
Well, it's Trentham Gardens.
Trentham Gardens.
So what are you saying?
Heidi, does it matter?
No! Heidi Trentham has a foot rash. It's raised, dry, scaly, wine-coloured. She says it does itch. For this one, I thought psoriasis.
Thought psoriasis myself, or potentially eczema.
Yeah. Heidi, you're going to need a cream of some sort. I would pop down to Boots, show them your foot.
Get your boots off.
In Boots.
Which is why I said it.
Ha-ha.
Stars from both of you, Jen.
I mean, that was liquid radio, as you could hear. And I just think it's just that attention to detail, and a shout out has to go to Catherine Kelly, who's playing his partner, one of the fittest women over 40 in Norfolk, as he describes her himself. And I just think it's so satisfying to watch him again. So it's got to be 5 out of 5.
I think I would give a shout out to Felicity Montagu as the long-suffering assistant Lynn, who is just fantastic here. I have given up wondering, Rick, when Alan Partridge will stop being funny. I think at this point I'll take another 30 years if Steve Coogan has it in him. I thought this was funny, endearing, just irresistible. I was going to go with 4. I will actually go with 5. It's the best comedy on television at the minute.
Okay, next up, a hotly anticipated new drama about one of the greatest British media scandals of recent decades. The Hack stars David Tennant, and it charts the investigation into illegal phone hacking that ultimately led to the closure of the News of the World. Jen, take us back to this scandal that had so many on the edge of their seats for so long.
Okay, so we have to set things up because the show is wild. So in a very basic way, for those who do need a refresher, David Tennant plays Nick Davies. He's a freelance journalist who is working for The Guardian, and he gets drawn into the story of how Rupert Murdoch's News of the World employed private investigators to illegally hack the phones of thousands of people in the UK. So including celebrities, sports stars, politicians, families of high profile murder victims and ordinary folk to generate their big scoops. And then running parallel to that story is the story
that involves Robert Carlyle's character. He's Dave Cook. He's a Met detective looking into the murder of Daniel Morgan. So he was a private investigator who was killed in a car park in 1987. And the case is linked in a roundabout way to the phone hacking through the News of the World, because his business partner at their business, Southern Investigations, who was this local police officer, he went to go on to reposition this firm, and he was selling police information to Rupert Murdoch's News of the World. So these two stories, very different stories, but they intersect as the show continues. But initially, as a viewer, you would be forgiven for thinking you're watching two separate shows entirely. And that is because of the stylistic choices that Jack Thorne makes.
And in fact, in episode one, the first story is the only one that really exists for those people who maybe saw it last night on Virgin Media. I want to play the I Want Out clip here, which is David Tennant's Nick Davies. And he's had enough and he meets his editor at the Guardian newspaper to look for a new assignment. That's Alan Rusbridger, played by the great Toby Jones.
I want out.
Do you know anything about baking competitions?
No.
I want to know how many people cheat at baking competitions. Round number.
Exactly the sort of thing the Guardian should be investigating. I don't mean out altogether. I'd like to go to Brussels, investigate a whole new horizon, something well paid.
Naturally.
That will allow me to commute. The kids are old enough now to be able to.
I need you here. Sadiq Khan, bugged. 40-year convention breached. And why? Keep the Americans happy. Needs a good journalist.
I'm knackered. Nobody likes me.
Oh, come on. I like you. Some of the time. And I'm sure there are a few others who also...
Please.
Self-pity's not a redeeming quality. We'll talk tomorrow.
I'm freelance. Precisely, so I don't need to talk to you tomorrow.
You're freelance with more or less a sole employer. I'd say you should talk to me tomorrow.
So, Chris, in the first episode, at least, David Tennant spends a fair amount of time breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience. Does that work as a device?
In short, no. Yeah, David Tennant goes full on Ferris Bueller as a journalist, or, you know, Fleabag mode. I think this is obviously an incredibly important story, and it should be a very important show, something like Mr. Bates, you know, versus the Post Office for 2025. And you think on paper, at least, it has all the elements in place. It has a tremendous cast. You've got a supporting cast that includes Rose Leslie, Catherine Kelly again, Steve Pemberton, heavily made up to resemble Rupert Murdoch, and it actually kind of works. And you also have an exceptional writing team, Jack Thorne, who's just had an extraordinary success with Adolescence recently, and then David Tennant. So great team. Why doesn't it work? I think it doesn't work because it's so awkwardly framed and handled when it comes to the Nick Davies character, at least. So he's forever turning to the camera and explaining what's happening and making jokes about everything. He obviously can't name some of his sources, so the writing team think they're having a great deal of fun with, you know, the names of certain people. Let's have this character be called Buzz Aldrin. Let's have this character be called Mr. Apollo. Let's, at a moment when, you know, Nick Davies is meeting the most important source of all, have fun with the casting. So there's this weird sequence.
Oh, that moment.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the face I made. Jonathan Ross answers the door, then Gabby Logan, then Harry Hill, because the show is kind of having fun saying, this could be anyone. And I was thinking to myself, you're losing the star for this. This is so important. The stuff that we're about to get into, the people whose phones were hacked, the lives that this affected, I don't think we should be doing this. And don't even get me started on this. Such a peculiar motif that involves a dung beetle pushing around... dung. I don't understand. Like, at one stage, Nick Davies is talking to his son about how this is life. You know, we're all like dung beetles, just kind of, you know, eventually something good will happen to us. It's one thing to have that sort of line. It's another to have this cartoonish daydream involved in a series like this. It doesn't work.
Okay, let's get stars from both of you. Jen?
I think Jack Thorne is probably too impressed with his subjects, and it's very hard to make people care about something nebulous about morals rather than something that's visceral, like Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. You're talking about honour and respect and all of that. So I do think the landscape of media has changed so much that I don't know if people care about the truth in this post-truth world. This is not All the President's Men.
And as well
this
as
is
that,
not Jack Thorne's All the President's Men,
Is there an element of that because we now live in a world where we all just presume that, you know, international companies are just looking at everything that we write anywhere ever that this story seems almost historical.
It feels like a completely different time now, post fake news. And I do think there is a moment that if I was Rusbridger, I would be livid, because if that's the way they're representing my hair, I think Toby Jones and David Tennant are duking it out for the worst wigs on TV at this very moment in time. So I was really looking forward to this, but I have to say I was very disappointed. So I could only give it a 2.5.
Chris?
I was too disappointed, yeah, but I am looking forward to seeing how Robert Carlyle's story follows, because I understand that that's framed completely differently. And look, journalism, it is hard to convey on screen. A lot of journalism is boring. There's an awful lot of phone calls, knocking on doors, sitting around wondering, you know, what works, what doesn't work, when to publish and all the rest of it. But it has been done well before. Look, a spotlight, look, All the President's Men. I expected more of Jack Thorne, of David Tennant. I will stick with it to see how Robert Carlyle gets on, but it's a bumpy start. It's a 2.5 out of 5.
Okay, finally this evening, the American football comedy Chad Powers, an extremely talented, if arrogant, American football quarterback who seems to have the world at his feet until it all goes terribly wrong. Jen, you said this was the strangest show you've seen all year. Tell me about it.
I mean, I was like, is Chad Powers a psyops? Like, that's what I thought halfway through watching this series, because there was no other way I could explain it to myself. Like, what is Chad Powers? I mean, and what is Hollywood's dude bro du jour Glenn Powell doing? Like, why does he think this is a good idea? So on the one hand, Chad Powers is very traditional. It's a very Disney prospect. It's the story about this disgraced college footballer. He's an irritating himbo, Russ Halliday, who becomes infamous for prematurely celebrating a touchdown before he crossed into the end zone, and that cost him this team the national championship. And then he ends up lashing out at a fan on the sideline whose son had cancer, and he ends up punching the dad and falling into the son, who's in a wheelchair, and knocked him over. So his career was, he was beyond cancelled. So he's trying to eke his way back onto the football field some years later, and he's landed this contract with the XFL, only for that to be cancelled because the child that he knocked over those years ago dies. And his name and that moment has become viral again due to this. So he's stuck at home and his career hopes are dashed. His Oscar-winning makeup artist dad, who's actually brilliantly played by Toby Huss, who I love, he sends him on this errand to his studio lot where he sees a billboard for Mrs. Doubtfire. And at that exact moment, he hears a report about open tryouts for this team, the South Georgia Catfish, puts two and two together about them losing two quarterbacks, and a light goes off and he takes off with his father's makeup kit and becomes Chad Powers.
Chris, it's supposed to be a comedy. Is it funny?
No. No, I don't think so. And I like Glenn Powell. I think that man's, you know, he's elevated so many projects from like so romantic comedies, Anyone But You with Sidney Sweeney, to, you know, mid-level legacy sequels like Twisters. He has this energy, he has this, you know, star wattage, this charm that makes him, you know, he could be a huge movie star. I think he's maybe punching down here. And I think he's misread the room, and he's misread what... He has this idea that maybe he's got a Ted Lasso, Mrs. Doubtfire sort of project on his hands. And those are two projects that have an awful lot of fans, and also detractors too. But I think he misunderstands what made those projects work. I mean, Ted Lasso as a character annoys a lot of people, but you can't deny that he does have a big heart, and that, you know, there is a smidgen of charm to him. Even people that hate him might admit that. And then Mrs. Doubtfire, Robin Williams' character there, look, there was all sorts of problems with that character. But Robin Williams wasn't playing a jerk. He wasn't playing someone that was completely irredeemable and obnoxious. The problem with Chad Powers is that the person behind him is just so unlikable. We are talking about someone who is so selfish, who doesn't realize that massive mistake that he made with the terminally ill fan, who doesn't even apologize for it. He's this wild conspiracy theorist as well. He comes out with the most awful things. You can't root for him. And if you can't root for the man behind Chad Powers, then how are you supposed to root for the person that he's pretending to be?
Okay, stars from you.
I think Glenn Powell can and has done better. Hopefully, this is an idea that he had based on an ESPN sketch. He's gotten it out of his system. I don't know whether he wants to do another season. Stick to the films. You're supposed to be the new Tom Cruise. Do that. So 2 stars.
I think you have to suspend your disbelief when you're looking at the unveiling of Chad Powers, because it looks like the result of an Owen Wilson and a capybara coupling. I just think this stuff like this works for Adam Sandler because he can push those characters to the very limits with his unpredictability, but he doesn't have it. Glenn Powell does not have that. So I'd give it a 2.
Okay, my thanks to Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. How are you? It's Alan Partridge Begins on BBC One on Sunday. The Hack continues on Virgin Media TV on Thursday. Chad Powers is streaming now on Disney+. You are listening to Friday Night's Arena. The news was announced today of the death of Monachán McGann, who did so much to share his love of nature and his love of the Irish language. He was a guest here on Arena in 2022, and we thought we might finish tonight with this. Here he is performing with his friend, Ilan Piper, Louise Mulcahy.
Níl quill, níl lawa, níl bach. Dar chroig dia níl far, nach dúl gastoin alas. Níl ban ní chadavach neav him, a yenav da nim níl. There's not a fly, a mot, a bee, man or woman created by God, whose welfare is not our responsibility. To ignore their predicament isn't all. Níl gált in laun na gált, nor cuí doin síl am ash. A shunnachan an ad oom priam har ar gyaun ar dinas in the viawr. There's not a mad man in Mad Valley that we shouldn't sit with and keep company. Since he's sick in the head on our behalf, níl áit, níl shroch, níl shcach, da ir gulti iad níl nach, vidis huig, hir, hir no no has, nar cart doing machnav er hir, le gyaun is le baoyat. There's not a place, a stream, a bush, however remote, or a flagstone, north, south, east, or west, that we shouldn't consider without affection and empathy. Da ad oin Afric has, da ir de I galach, is quid doin iad o hiat, níl áit fud na crinna, na áit a sealiach sinna. No matter how far South Africa, no matter how distant the moon, they're part of us by right. There's not a single spot anywhere that we're not a part of. We issue from everywhere.
And that's the late Monachán McGann with Louise Mulcahy on Ilan Pipes, recorded on Arena back in 2022. Kulasov, Monaco. That is it for Arena for tonight and for this week. The programme produced by Sheila O'Callaghan tonight. Liam Murphy was on research. Anna Rose Charlton was our broadcast coordinator, and sound supervision tonight was by Harry Booklist. Don't forget, you can listen back to any of the items that we've done on Arena this week on the RTE radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rick O'Shea. I will talk to you again Monday night from 7 here on Radio 1, and Fíochna O'Brien is in for John Creedon tonight.